Time to listen to the interviews from Island Life on Saturday the 17th of July. Island Life is our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. It's brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 to 12 by Island, the stockist of Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local gifts, art and clothing. You'll find them in Ocean View Road, Oneroa. On Saturday the 17th of July 2010, Sharon Brown talked to budgeting course tutor Millie Watkins and Rainbow Warrior Martini.
Hi, this is Sharon, and you're listening to Island Life. Late start today. Yes, but here we are. Millie Pickle is in with us. She's doing a course at community education starting next week. Is that right?
Starting on the 3rd of August.
Starting on the 3rd of August. So there's a way to go yet, but it's quite nice to get the information out there for people who might be interested. And then Martini's coming in at 11:15 to talk about the film that was made, the Rainbow Warriors of Waiheke Island, and also about Peter Bethwen, who was on a whaling ship that was taken by the Japanese, or he actually boarded a Japanese vessel and was taken to Japan. I'm sure most of you know that story, and he's here to talk about that. So great. Hey, Millie, so how's it going?
It's going pretty good. In fact, I was at a party for Pete Bethune last night at the Cargo Bar, his welcome home party.
Lovely.
And it was good to see him back.
And what did he, I mean, did you know him before?
We did have some acquaintance with him, and then we kept in touch during the time that he was incarcerated. And he wrote my son Finn a gorgeous letter, and so he's been really good, especially to Finn. He's a great model.
Lovely.
So definitely one of our New Zealand heroes and somebody to be celebrating.
Mm. Did he have anything to say about being in jail in Japan? That can't have been a very inspiring experience.
He had a lot to say. There were a lot of really interesting things. As you can imagine, there was a great media staging from the very beginning. So the way that he was brought into the country and the way that he was brought through the jail was all meant to emphasize to the public that he was a sinister character, and in that way that you would portray someone as being really evil so you can whip up a lot of public support for what you're doing. So, you know, I don't know if you're familiar, but he was brought in with 100. He was escorted by 100 guards. And he was he had a black hood, and it was in shackles. And so everything was very dramatic. And then going into the jail, he had 12... guards bring him into the jails, which was the best thing that they could ever have done for him, because everybody in the jail left him alone, because most people going into jail are escorted by one person. So obviously someone who's escorted by 12 must be such a dangerous character that everyone steered clear of him, and that suited him just fine. For him, the most challenging thing was the solitary. It was really a lot of solitary confinement. His one funny story was that he befriended a spider. The Japanese are neat freaks. And so he had to go through some things every once in a while to save the spider from the Japanese vacuum cleaner, because they'd come through and, you know, just really clean everything, and he'd manage to squirrel him away. And he would put a little orange peel out in his little slit of a window and catch a bug and bring it inside and feed his, and that was his company.
Oh my goodness.
But, you know, he's such a strong character that it all ends up sounding like a good story. Mm. I don't know how many of us could go through an experience like that.
Did he talk about whether he felt that he'd done the right thing by boarding the Japanese vessel, or would he do that again?
Yeah, absolutely. Really, he did his part. It was up to the government, and it was up to whatever other forces, whether it be public support or all the other things, for them to do their part. Mm. And you can't always count on everyone to do their part, but he did his.
Did he feel disappointed by the way the New Zealand government behaved?
Perhaps. He didn't mention anything, but I would imagine you would be. I mean, he has said that he didn't feel like he got support from the New Zealand government. So whether he's disappointed or not, yeah, I would imagine he would be. I know I would be if I went to a foreign country and didn't have my own country watching my back. That would be both a disappointment and a concern, because certainly if someone with as high a profile as Pete Bethune can have that happen to him, what hope is there for the rest of us who might find ourselves in trouble in another country?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a really interesting situation. I always think that whaling thing in the Japanese is such a strange one, because I lived in Japan for a year, and well, it is that thing of no one really eats whale meat. No one really cares about whale meat. Probably half the population love whales. But it's this thing, I think it's this thing of feeling dictated to by other people that they just can't stand. And I think it's that that just makes them, you know, dig their heels in and say, no, we're going to go on doing this. Did you see The Cove?
Yes.
Yeah, that I thought was really interesting, in that these two people from a city council in the area where they do the whaling actually stood up and said, we absolutely do not want whale meat to be part of school lunches. Children have no choice but to eat it, and the stuff is full of mercury. We absolutely do not want our children eating this whale meat.
Mm. They both ended up, I believe, they were both taken off the board eventually, but they did make their stand, and they did win.
Mm. But for a community-oriented country, that was an incredible stand to make.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I worked in Japan, I had a friend who went cycling with a cycling group. And they, you know, when they did their cycling bit, they all, you know, afterwards they had a big lunch and, you know, chatted. And her Japanese was okay, but she was just interested in being out in nature for a change. So she'd kind of wander off and you know, do her own thing after she'd had lunch. And there was such kind of reprimand, like she wasn't in any of the pictures, and people really held it against her that she didn't do the community side of things after the cycling. And a lot of this, my experience when I was there was the same, that you don't, you know, you do things for community and you don't just kind of do your own thing. So yeah, that was incredibly brave.
Well, what Pete Bethune has said about the government's stance is that the power block is old men, and those are the people who are specifically attached to the idea to continuing whaling, whether it be a form of national identity. And yeah, just as you said, you're not going to tell us what to do. But it is that power block, and they do run the country. And so although the bulk of the public may be ambivalent, the people who are making the choices are definitely in favor. And Pete had mentioned that he wasn't sure what effect it would have. In other words, if you make a big deal about it, do people all of a sudden start eating whale or start having a position about it because they, you know, they hold to that national identity, or do they start to take a look at it and rethink it? So he said he didn't know which way it would go.
Mm. And which way did he think it was going?
It's early days. It was a huge deal. He is public enemy number one in Japan, and it's only just a week since he's been back. So we'll
see. Did he have some support from the Japanese NGOs? Because, I mean, you know, Greenpeace is there. Friends of the Earth was quite strong there.
It's hard to say,
yeah.
Because I think his access to various channels was pretty limited. So he had access to the Japanese embassy and to, you know, various other government officials, but I don't know how widely people had access to him. So he may not have been able to access any of that support, you know, and I don't think he could say what was available or what wasn't.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that was Pete Bethune we were just talking about. But what we were here to talk about was the course that Millie's teaching at Continuing Education. And by the way, a lot of the courses for Continuing Education start on Monday. So this is the first week of their regular program, but this is a special course that Millie's teaching. So tell us about it.
So it's going to be running for 8 weeks, and it does require an early registration. And the reason for that is that we have tried to price it so that we can just cover the venue hire and the materials. But we do need to know ahead of time so that we can have the appropriate number of materials available. So pre-registration, I believe that's pretty much the case with community education courses, but really, really would be helpful in this case. So
in the true style of infomercials, we are going to actually tell you what the course is now that we've told you about the importance of pre-registering.
Yeah. So FI stands for Financial Independence, Financial Intelligence, and Financial Integrity. And what this is not is it's not a get-rich-quick scheme, and it's not a make-a-killing in the stock market or, you know, you can go on Easy Street. It's really about taking a good look at how you spend money and whether it's in line with how you want to spend money and starting to get a feeling of control over finances. And what people find going through this program is week by week you add another step, and I'll go through those in a minute. And out of that process, people are able to get out of debt and develop some savings for themselves. And also in the process resolve some inner conflicts between their values and their lifestyle. It helps people to reorder their material priorities and actually live well for less. The reason that I am supporting doing this as a group, there are some different ways of going through this course. It's freely available online. You can look up financial, I think it's listed as financial integrity. And you can download the course materials and go through it on your own. If you wanted to go through it with a group of people in the online world, you can do that in a forum style, and they'll take you through the materials as a group, but that's a dislocated, I'm on my computer and, you know, that kind of setup. Or the materials can be used as a group with a facilitator. And so the reason that I wanted to bring this to Waiheke, it's something that I have gone through myself in the past. So I have gone through the materials on my own. I also went through the online course again with a group and did it in the forum style. And so this is the first time for me to do it as a group. And personally, money has always been a tricky issue for me. I think for everyone, it's kind of a slippery thing, having enough and feeling like you can have some sense of inner security about what you have. There's a lot of anxiety around it. And so I think I, like probably most people, have struggled with that over my life. And what this course has allowed me to do at various times in my life is to get a grip on what I have and using my resources so that I get the most out of them, and then building from there. And so it goes through some really simple principles about exploring enough, the principle of enoughness, which is different for everyone. So it's not about following a prescription, one size fits all. It's about, as a group, looking into our own financial mindset, if you will, and applying some very specific concrete tools for really looking squarely and honestly at what we spend and whether it's doing for us what we want, and then starting to develop some ways of having the money used for what we want it to be used. And what people generally find is that once they go through this process, they start to see themselves moving from a place of debt and lack and into a place of empowerment and decision-making and ability to live the lifestyle of the real choice. And that's dictated by what really suits us personally, not the vision of a lifestyle that perhaps is portrayed through the media. And not to say that, you know, anything that's portrayed through the media is wrong, but that each of us can make a choice about what of that we would take rather than taking the whole.
Okay, interesting. Can you give us some concrete examples?
Sure.
Or some, you know, one of the tools that you're thinking of? I mean, like even something like in terms of enough, like how, what are some of the ways you could look at that or some of the tools you could use?
So I'll just run through the steps because there are 9 steps and they go sequentially. And the first step is how much money has come into your life and what do you have to show for it? And this step is about taking a clear, honest look at your current financial situation and how you got there. And this is important in orienting yourself toward positive change. So specifically, during this step, you'll review your earning history and get an idea of how much money has come into your life throughout your entire working life. And you'll then take a look at how you've managed it and review what you own and what you owe in order to get an accurate picture of your financial situation today. And getting clear with the past prepares you to come into the present and make positive changes into the future.
Oh, that's interesting. So it's almost like saying,
if you've had a pattern of earning this amount, then and you've lived comfortably on it, then why would you suddenly want to be earning so much more? Is that what the intention is, to take away some of that anxiety?
A lot of people feel as though they've never earned enough, and a lot of people don't know exactly how much they've earned. And so through this step, it is quite often people find themselves surprised with how much they've actually earned in their life. And it's the first kind of head-scratching moment where someone says, wow, that's a lot of money. Where did it all go? And so then we also look at assets and liabilities. So things that you have to show for it and things that you owe. So it's whenever we want to come to grips with any problem, we have to really become very, very clearly focused on the whole landscape of how we got there. And money seems to be something that I know in my case, I go through and I almost don't want to think about it. I want it to be there when I want it, but I don't want to spend a lot of time thinking about it. And in a way that helps me because I don't spend that time fussing and obsessing about it. But in another way, it hurts me because I don't know the landscape. And so, for instance, when my situation changes, so I've gone in my life to being a single mom with two kids to being in a blended family with six kids and a whole lot of associated financial issues that are surround that. And so if I don't have a sense of my current landscape, it's going to be hard for me to make a smooth transition when there are different requirements. So step two is about taking a closer look at the way money moves in and out of our lives, day in and day out, and taking a look at what money is and developing a reality-based definition of money that helps see what it really means in our lives. So this is about calculating things like your real hourly wage. So you have your wage that you get when you go to your job. The things you don't think about are things like, I work in Auckland, and so obviously I have my transportation costs. I get there and I'm hungry, and I can't just get something from the kitchen. So I have a certain level of cost that goes into maintaining just my basic needs. My job perhaps requires me to have a certain standard of dress and presentation. Could be haircuts, could be makeup, or it could be, you know, ties or the right suit, or, you know. So there are a lot of things that go along with our wage. And when we look at that number, we don't always see the things that are behind it. So that's a bit of step two, is looking at what it is. And when you calculate all those things out, then you get what you actually take home. And so for some people, they might find, you know, they're working at home and they might find that it's definitely on the plus side and very strong. For other people, they might find, wow, you know, between everything I'm doing and spending and what I'm getting, that doesn't seem quite worth it. Perhaps I want to realign where I'm working and what my job situation is. It's a potential outcome of that. In step three, we use the information that's been gathered in the previous 2 weeks and tracking to see what patterns come out of that. So we take a look at, we establish our own spending categories. So instead of, you know, usually when you go to a budgeting thing, you see the standard line of categories that everyone's supposed to fill out, and you try to fit yourself into that. And this is about coming up with your own categories that are based on what you actually spend money on. So it's an individual. And from that, basically, the monthly tabulation shows what you're actually doing with your money in the present and provides an accurate portrait of your lifestyle and your spending patterns. And then in step four, you evaluate how you earn and spend the money and see if it aligns with what you want. So you ask yourself three questions about each of the categories, your spending categories. Did I receive fulfillment in proportion to the life energy? Because the money that you earned is your life energy. Did I really get the most bang out of the buck with that?
Everyone would give up makeup, wouldn't they?
And was this in alignment with my values, goals, and purpose? So at what point do we ever jump off the merry-go-round and look at what we're actually spending money on and say, is that piece in line with everything else? And bringing it up to speed with perhaps the rest of your life. And then how would this change if I didn't have to work for a living. So in other words, if I have a very high spending category for clothing, if I didn't have to work for a living, that whole piece might drop off tremendously, and it would change the picture. So if I were to say, I have to keep working because I have this much expense, if we take a look at the things that would fall away or somehow be transformed and be less expensive, then it might change the picture of what we do for a living. And in step five is creating a visual tool to show how much money flows in and out of your life over time. So it's a big wall chart that shows monthly financial progress. So at the end of the month, you've calculated your income and your expenses, and they just go in a different line. And so I have kept mine over the years, over the past, I think I've had it for about 10 years. It's a big graph and little spaces. And it's been in my living room sometimes. Sometimes it's been in my closet. I don't have a personal hang-up about people seeing my finances, but some people might and would want to put it somewhere where only they would see it.
So what determines whether it's in the closet or in the living room? What psychological state are you in when you bring it out and you put it back in again?
Actually, it was actually really very simple. It's finding the wall space. So in certain places, it's been appropriate. There's been space to have it in the wall. The place where it was in the closet.
But wait, you live in a closet? Then
yeah. Well, the time that it was in the closet, I lived in the mud brick. And you couldn't stick blue tack onto mud brick. So the only place that had jib was the closet.
Right. Okay. Fair enough.
Or the bathroom. And I didn't want to put it in the bathroom.
Okay. Why didn't you want to put it in the bathroom?
Because of the moisture. Because it would peel and everything would come off the wall. It's actually very practical.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
I wish I could.
So I bet you spent half the session deciding where you're going to stick
the
water.
That's right.
Okay, excellent. So so just a question. Do you have to be kind of flaky and alternative to do this course? Because, essentially, at a certain point, when you start to question those kinds of values, what you might decide is that you actually just want to opt out and not really do anything. I mean, when I say not really do anything, not work for money.
Many people have taken this course, have gotten themselves to a place where they don't have to work for money, and they end up putting their time into things of value. But I would not call it flaky, because the elder people in our community who are on retirement and are supported put their time into their community in ways that have nothing to do with anything alternative, but actually just support the community. And one of the things that I see as a danger when you get on the treadmill of working and living just to work is that you do not have that energy to spend on your community. And so it's a debit from the community, the way that things are working right now. And so for me, the reason that I'm facilitating it is the greatest service that I can provide is to work on myself and to provide a supportive atmosphere for a group of people to align themselves so that they're no longer working for a living and are able to put their energy back into the community, because that's the greatest resource.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting in terms of free time as well. I mean, I think the way people work now, certainly in my job, in relation to the way they worked 20 years ago, there's a lot more stress.
Yes.
Even, in the teaching profession, by the time you comply with all the administrative requirements, that are really often only there as a way of making sure you're doing your job, because the trust in your ability to do your job has somehow been eroded. The fact that you're employed and qualified to do a job effectively, there isn't that much trust there. And so you have all these administrative controls. And then by the time you finish complying with all of that, your job is actually extended in time and your free time is taken away.
Yes.
So, Okay, and other points? Anything else you wanted to say?
Well, just that what we're hoping to do is we're hoping to hold this course regularly. And to me, it's a bit like a Coast Guard, it's a bit like a day skipper or a boatmaster course for financial literacy. I see it as most of us have gone through life, and, I'm definitely in that category, of not taking an economics course and trying to live my life aside from money and kind of having an uneasy peace with that. And so the more we educate ourselves about that, it can lead to, as a group, making some other decisions. And so this would also form the foundation of often what can spin off from this is a group might decide to go further with a common security club is one group that has been started. And these are all not-for-profit endeavors. None of this has anything to do with making you rich. But a common security club allows a group together to explore some issues. So I'll raise just one issue when we have mortgages that are upside down. People are not earning enough money to make those mortgages, and we start getting foreclosures. We start looking at an issue of whether housing is a right or a privilege. And so in other countries, common security clubs that have started have provided group support to individuals who are dealing with situations like that. And so there has been a very strong movement in places that have seen a lot of foreclosures in turning that around and helping people stay in their homes. So that's just one example of some really practical things that can come out of this when you get freed up and start looking at things just a little bit differently.
Oh, interesting. So does that? What kind of support did that involve? Did that involve financial support or protesting support?
It was protesting support and network support. A lot of times, one of the things that you deal with mortgages is we have a myth about mortgages and being an upstanding citizen, and that it's the mark of being an upstanding citizen. And if we're upside down in our mortgage and we can't afford to pay it, we tend to take that personally. And so what this group does is it allows people to get informed so that they don't take it personally and they become informed of their rights, because without that, the banks can come in and tread on people's lack of knowledge.
Right. Yeah. Oh, no, it sounds good. Okay, so that course starts on the 3rd of August?
Yes.
Lovely.
And runs for 8 weeks on Tuesday nights from, I think it's 6:30.
6:30 to 8, something like that. But if you look in the Gulf News every week, and maybe the Marketplace, I'm not sure, but certainly the Gulf News, there is a...
course listing. Right.
And you can call the community education number.
Exactly.
Which is...
And pre-register.
Not sure what the number is, but you can pre-register and register for other courses that you might be interested in. Thanks very much. That was Millie Pickle.
Thank you for giving me the time. It is actually Millie Watkins. But
oh, sorry.
No, that's
sorry.
Okay.
It is Millie Watkins.
But thank you for having me on so I could talk about that.
Lovely. Cheers. Okay, have a lovely day.
You're listening to Island Life, Waiheke People, Events and Issues, brought to you by Island. Art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Ocean View Road, Onirua.
Okay. Well, great. Well, I've got Martini here, who you will know from Sunday Night, The Navigator, which is an excellent music program. Really enjoy that one, world music. And anyway, he's here to talk about the film that he was showcased in, amongst other people who also live on Waiheke, as one of the people who was on the Rainbow Warrior and worked with Greenpeace at the time that the ship was sunk. So tell us about the process of filming that film, the documentary.
The process. It started off as an idea in the Netherlands. The Dutch Greenpeace office there, they were celebrating their 30th year, and they were going to publish a book, you know, about their history. And I got requests for info or this or that. I kind of forgot now. I'm probably in that book. But the person who contacted me got kind of astonished that all these people were living on Waiheke Island. And they all had a Greenpeace history. So they started to think about, well, why is that? How come? And... So we got further contact, and Suzanne and Renske. Suzanne is the director, and Renske was the researcher, and get all the footage together.
Are they in Greenpeace?
Renske is, but Suzanne isn't. Renske is, I think he still is, or was, I don't know, I can't remember that. But anyway, they both came over and, you know, had a talk with everybody here, and they had a little camera and they shot some, made some short little interviews, and they put something together for funding, and there's plenty of funding in Holland actually for film, but they got the funding, and they came out last year in May for about 2 weeks and shot the whole thing in 2 weeks.
So what is the answer to that question? Why are there so many people from the Rainbow Warrior now living in Waiheke Island?
Well, I can't speak for anybody else, but for myself it's simple. You know, I got a mate within Greenpeace, Rien Achterberg, and, you know, I know the man now for 36 years, and, you know, he's like a brother to me. I came back to Waiheke in 2001. I was working at the Greenpeace office as director of the marine operations and helicopter operations, etc. In Amsterdam, that was the head office. But I had a bit of a breakdown, you know. And they brought me back to Waiheke Island and to Rien, you know. And because that's was my home. When I lived on Waiheke before I went to Amsterdam. I lived, you know, my middle son, he was born here. It was his birthday yesterday. Birthday, Mo, 14 years.
Ah, happy birthday.
So, you know, I've been on the island for a long time. But when I came back, I finished my job in Amsterdam. I came back and now I'm a freelancer. And I had a year contract. But if I'm a freelancer, I need the internet. And at that time, there was no broadband yet on Waiheke. So I stayed in Blockhouse Bay in Auckland for a year, which was one of the biggest mistakes I made in my life. But that's another story. My mate Henk Hazen and, you know, the partner of Bunny, who are also in the movie, he had a little house in Nico Road, a small house, and I moved in there with my three kids, so he became my landlord, you know. I'm still wondering how he managed to do that. I'm still a renter.
Excellent. Ah, okay. And do you know what the budget was for the film in the end?
No, I don't want to know about those things.
Right, okay. Because I do find that it's a heartbreaking. I mean, I know when you talk about it being a small camera and et cetera, it was actually a really nice camera that they brought over, and they brought a crew of four people. And I appreciate that all of this stuff could happen from Holland, but there's a part of me which feels for the filmmakers in New Zealand, which feels that, you know, we live here, and yet it is so difficult to raise even a minimal amount of funding to make a film like that.
Exactly.
You know, and so that's kind of, you know, my frustration.
I fully agree. It's a documentary, you know. It's not a documentary. And but I know it had a sizable budget. I mean, they had to fly four people over, and they were all professional people, you know. The cameraman, he had made movies himself. The sound man has always been into sound. Good point is he was bass player in one of the best Dutch bands in the 60s, 70s, The Outsiders. But they were all professional people, eh? I was very impressed by the with the cameraman, and the sound is brilliant, and you know, it's also a movie about Waiheke Island, really, you know, that's what it is, because there's so many shots and so many things which we can all recognize, and probably there's a whole lot of people on the island, that's me, and I think that's great, you know, and that really, to me, that shows what a good place it is that we live on, you know.
Yeah, no, that's fabulous. Oh, no, really great. Well done. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the film.
Yeah, so we will. I haven't done anything about it because, you know, I find it a bit hard to go and promote. You know, it's in a sense, it's not my movie, you know. I'm in it, you know. But I'm not going to do bloody self-promoting. But that is, but it will come in the cinema here, probably on the Koa evenings. And we're making contact with the cinema. And it will be here, so, you know, hopefully a couple of times. And everybody on the island who wants to watch it can watch it.
Oh, sounds fabulous. Yeah. Good. And so can I just... talk a little bit about that whole thing with the Rainbow Warrior. I know it must be, I mean, it's quite a long time ago, but I would imagine it's still quite present. But how did your feelings about Greenpeace or your involvement in that, you know, in all of this activism change as a result of the, you know, the bombing of the Rainbow Warrior?
Well, I always stayed with Greenpeace. You know, the only change which happened for me after the bombing was that instead of me going back on the ship, I started to work in the office and you know, became manager of the ships. We had the Antarctica campaign running at that time every year. We put a base camp in Antarctica, and every year we had a resupply. And during the voyage there, we had campaigns on whaling and a whole range of other issues in the Southern Ocean. And I also became responsible.
That's nice. Martini's phone. That's mine. We now get to chat to someone he knows.
No, I don't chat. You know, turn it off. Yeah, why not? What was it talking about? I also became responsible of the sinking of the ship, you know, so I had to deal with, on a pure operational matter. But, you know, a lot of people contacted Greenpeace and offering what to do with Rainbow Warrior because, you know, it was not really... of course, it was an attack on a Greenpeace ship. Ah, bugger this. I hate these mobile phones. I put them under my foot.
The mobile phone is now right under his foot. Don't forget it's under your
don't
foot.
Don't forget when I stand up. Okay. It will ring again, but don't worry about that. That's part of it. The attack was not only an attack on Greenpeace. It was an attack on New Zealand. And it was an attack on the anti-nuclear movement in New Zealand. I mean, the French knew... in 85, that besides the Rainbow Warrior, there would be a hell of a lot of other yachts going. They were all preparing in Auckland. The whole fleet was going to go. And in the end, that's the bottom line of all, that the issue here is always nuclear weapons. And this was a campaign to stop nuclear weapon testing. We had... earlier success when testing was stopped in the atmosphere, but after 85 it took another 10 years, but we had a total stop to underground nuclear testing as well. So, you know, if you look at that part and that combination, that in the end is always what counts, what you try to do. Hey, I can stop it with my feet.
Excellent.
You can stop it with your feet. And that's something you always have to remember. The good thing about the movie, really the good thing about the movie, is that it also, as a little bit of a centerpiece, is the campaign we did before the ship arrived in Auckland. And that was the evacuation of the whole population of Rongelap in the Marshall Islands, which were suffering because in the Bravo test in 1951 caused an enormous amount of radiation on the island. The kids were standing on the beach one morning and the sun came up in the west. And then it started to snow, flakes, and they were all wondering, what the heck is this then?
And they hadn't been warned?
No warning whatsoever.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because much was known about nuclear weapons, and yet you just have a population and you just totally ignore them.
They've been used like guinea pigs, you know. They needed people to see the result because it was always new. And, you know, so this whole radiation in people is still... it's still a valid issue today, you know. The French workers, the Tahitian workers at Mururoa, they had to do the dirty work, you know, and they had been in contact with plenty of radiations. There were all sorts of accidents and mishaps there at Mururoa, and there have been whole areas which are heavily contaminated, and they were usually in the cleanup operation, so they got radiated too. But the thing is, it never goes away. It stays in the kids, and then it goes from generation to generation. And the nuclear weapon states, I think they were hoping that everybody would die, so the problem would go away.
Oh, I see.
But that is not the case. They've been always holding up on all sorts of claims. And now finally France has made some progress, I have to say that. But the progress is mainly for the French people. Rather than the Tahitians, and you know,
should I put a song on so you can answer?
Yeah, I answer
okay,
this
hang
phone.
On. I'll put a track
I know exactly who it is.
There we go.
Cool.
There's no deeper blue in the ocean that lies as deep as the blue of your laughing eyes. No sweeter sound in your gentle sigh. No heart was ever so pure. So dream pretty dreams, touch beautiful things. Let all the skies surround you. Swim with the swans and believe that upon some beautiful dawn, love will find you. Someday I'm bound away, wind and wings on the water. Oh, whatever may, you must stay and remain my beautiful daughter. There's no deeper blue in the ocean that lies as deep as the blue of your laughing eyes. No sweeter sand than your gentle sigh. Good night, Katy Bell. Good night.
Right, okay, so... the emergency has been dealt with. There is going to be no nuclear war, and Martini has just dealt with it. So well done there.
All right.
Okay, so we're just talking about the Rainbow Warrior and the terrible situation of the islanders during the underground nuclear testing. Where were the people from the Marshall Islands taken in the end?
We didn't take them very far. About 100 miles south in the northwestern part of Kwajalein Atoll, and Kwajalein Atoll is one of the biggest atolls in the world in size, It's also part of a huge U.S. military base, because the Marshals, and that still today is used as a target area for nuclear ICBMs. They fire them off from Vandenberg in California, and they shoot them to the direction of Kwajalein. And some of the islands and parts of the lagoon itself is used as target area. So it's an interesting place. There's footage of it in the movie, actually. But the atoll is huge, and they were in the most northwestern part to a little island within the lagoon atoll, of course, which had no people on it. And they've been there ever since.
And is that working for them?
Well, it's working in so far that they the houses and all that are there, and the gardens are planted, so they grow taro and all that, and they got fishing in the lagoon. But the problem with Pacific Island people is land is very important. Like Rongelap, that's their land. That's where they come from. That's theirs. Nobody else has a say over it, and they could only move to that particular island because it belonged to the island people on the island next door, and they allowed it to happen. But people, the Rongelap people, still feel it's not their land, and there has been work done on Rongelap with the topsoil and cleaning up, and there's been building going on Rongelap for an eventual return. But as far as I can believe, all the latest press reports about it is that the island is still, the radiation on the island is still four times higher than it permissible in the United States. And the United States has, this year, they told the Rongelap people that they have to return, otherwise all the funding to them will stop. So here we are, 25 years later, after the bombing, after their evacuation, here's the United States putting pressure on people to go back to the island, which we know is four times higher than permissible in the United States. And I think, Jesus, the nuclear weapons, the sooner you get rid of these suckers, the better it is, really, for the whole world community,
Yeah. Oh, no, it sounds really tragic. So why did it... I'm still quite curious to know why it came to a Greenpeace ship to be evacuating these people. Why?
They asked us.
They asked you to evacuate them.
Yeah, they asked us.
And they made an agreement with these other islanders to take them onto the island.
Yes, that was all set up beforehand.
Right.
Yeah, they asked us.
And who... Because, you've alluded to it, but when you arrive in a new place that's a piece of land, there are no houses, there are no gardens planted. You need a certain amount of resources in terms of grain, in terms of temporary lodging, in terms of materials, to be able to start all of that up. So where did all of that come from?
From their own place. We, besides the people, we also took all the houses with us. They were all taken apart. And that came with us on as a deck cargo. When we left, there was nothing there.
How many people did you move?
Well over 300.
On one ship?
On one ship, couple of trips.
Right.
We would sail during the night, but during the day in Rongelap, we would load the whole ship, and there's no wharf there. We were at anchor, and we had to take all these building materials, when I talk building material, lots of corrugated iron as well, and timbers, The houses were completely taken apart, and they were ready for removal. And so we worked all day to get all that business on board, loaded the ship all up. And
and how far away was the next destination?
100 miles. So
Is that one night sailing?
Yeah. Right. So we sailed in the afternoon, and we would arrive there in daytime. We had to go into the lagoon, you know, and you don't do that at nighttime. It's pretty dangerous, you know, little narrow gaps in the, you can see the ground both sides, you know. So you can't drink and drive, you know.
That's
because
right.
You have to keep a straight line.
Wow. Yeah. So that must count as one of the most interesting experiences you've had on the Rainbow Warrior.
Oh, by far.
Yeah.
Yeah, by far. That's you will never forget. You will never forget that. And the thing is, you know, it stays in you, you know. Like, I get uptight when I get very uptight when I read about how is that possible? 25 years later, same in Admiral Roa, you know, that the Tahitian workers still have to muck around with the French government to get the proper compensation they deserve. 25 years later. And you know, I'm very passionate about getting rid of nuclear weapons. That has to happen. There's no way out. It's ridiculous that, you know, five countries on the United Nations Security Council with veto rights are all nuclear power states. So to me, that tells me those with nuclear power have the biggest say on what's happening on this planet. And I think it's for the wrong reasons. I mean, if you look at nuclear weapons, the reality of it is they're weapons of terror. That's what they do, isn't it?
Mm.
You know?
I mean, there are issues.
You touch me and I blow you up. What kind of attitude is that?
Especially when they've got enough to blow up the world many times over.
Yes.
The other interesting thing I found, I've just come back from France, was I met some people who have been affected by the Chernobyl fallout, and that's in the south of France. People are taking medication and are on medication for the rest of their lives now for damage caused by a particular pocket of nuclear whatever fallout that fell in this particular area of France. And it seems incredible to me that happened such a long time ago, and yet these people miles away are affected.
That's radiation for you. It stays there.
Mm.
It stays there, and there's plenty of radiation in our atmosphere, which is there thanks to the atmospheric nuclear testing. It goes down for a while, but certain isotopes just stay there. That's the whole thing we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the renaissance of nuclear power, of which France is, of course, one of the masters. It's kind of ridiculous that's still going on. That is now presented as the solution towards global warming.
There's a documentary that's been made about how nuclear energy is actually the best energy because it doesn't create fossil fuel contamination. It's bizarre.
It's bizarre. It's absolutely bizarre.
Anyway, okay, well, I'm sure you've discussed this at length in other places, but I'd be really curious to know that whole decision to sink the Rainbow Warrior afterwards. Any thoughts on that? Were you happy with that decision, or you know, was it the right thing to do in retrospect? Were there other things that could have been done with that ship?
That issue was probably within Greenpeace one of the more difficult ones they ever had to make. And at the time of the bombing, we knew that the back of the Rainbow Warrior was broken. The big hole, the first one, that's no problem to repair. The most damaging one was the second bomb, which was on at the aft end of the ship where the prop is. And the blast of that twisted the whole back of the ship. We had salvage experts pretty much immediately onto the scene from Singapore. We had close relationship with a company. They rescued all the engines, but we also rely quite a bit on their opinion, what they say, what's possible. Now, let me say that no matter what damage, you can always repair it, but against what cost? And in 85, Greenpeace had quite a few officers, and they were certainly very popular in Holland and in Germany, where, you know, good sizable amount of money comes in, but they were not super rich. Don't say Greenpeace New Zealand was small, struggling in New Zealand, very small. So we had to make a decision. When I say we, it's not my decision, you know, I'm a crew member on the ship, no more. It was not my decision. Decision was made to sink it, for the simple reason that we didn't have the fund to repair it. Had we known that after the explosion, such a huge amount of money came into the organization and it made an explosive growth, then the question of money, we did have the money then to repair it.
So how long after was it sunk?
it took over a year. It took over a year. We had to, I started working in the Greenpeace New Zealand. I came back in March of 86 and started working on it, and the Raymond Worry was under my department. And there were so many requests for the ships, you know, to use as a museum and this and that. And by then, we never made a decision here, you know. We talked with people and this and that. And but then the decision was made. And I think the first, it's a long time ago now, I think the first people we talked to were tribes on the East Coast. And they weren't forthcoming, and then we got success in Matari Bay, and
was
particularly
to sink it as a place to
Dover
sink it.
Samuels. It was Dover Samuels who came to the rescue of Greenpeace and offered us the Matari Bay as the final resting place of the Rainbow Warrior.
Right. So I see a sequel, you know, Matari Bay.
Exactly.
Greenpeace Warriors.
She's still there.
Yeah.
She's
going
still
down
there.
To visit. Has it been a popular place for people to dive?
Yes,
to?
Yes. Many people dive on it.
Have you been down? Do
no,
you dive?
No, I don't dive, you know. If God wanted me to kind of go underwater, he would give me fins, you know.
Right, no, fair enough.
Yeah. Now I don't dive. I don't. But people say it's wonderful. It's still there.
And
at the time, we said, "Well, it's not that we can keep the warrior alive." You know, there was the deepest thought behind the sinking too, is by providing a resting place, he would create life. And that's exactly what happened, you know. Plant life, fish, they all became home to the ship, you know, and the ship is still there. And so instead of saving lives, you know, she would create life. And so she's still there. In my head, she's still there. But I know there were so many Greenpeace people who hated the idea of the warrior going down, and they probably still have problems with it. And I think sometimes too, maybe we could have repaired it. But then what, you know, ships don't have an eternal life. They die at one stage, you know. They're just like people sometimes, although they cost a lot more money than people, but they die, and you have to replace them. Mm. You know, I mean, we now on July the 10th, the keel was laid for the third Rainbow Warrior. So the second Rainbow Warrior, the replacement, is also going to be phased out. And there's probably a whole generation of people who say, what the heck are you going to do with that ship then, you know? Hmm. We will see what happens.
Right, so there's no decision been made on what will happen to that ship.
No,
because I like the idea of it being an above-air museum, you know, that people can go and visit.
Oh, there is, you know, in Dargaville. If you want to look at the mast, they're there in Dargaville.
Right.
And inside the museum, they got all sorts of Rainbow Warrior stuff, you know.
Oh,
have
they? I didn't know that.
Yes,
okay. Dargaville, the place to go.
Museum. And if you want to see the propeller of the ship, which is still there, visible, you have to walk up the hill at Matari Bay, because on top of the hill at Matari Bay, there's a wonderful monument. Was the name of the guy slipped me, but he made that monument in Victoria, Steve, with all the stones and the ark. And a similar thing is there on top of Matari Bay. And the prop, the original propeller, is part of that.
Oh, wow, that must be amazing. I'll have to go down. I didn't realize all of this. I'll have to go over and have a look.
Yeah. It's all there.
Okay, lovely. Okay, well, Martini, I've been dying to get you onto the show for so long, so thank you very much for coming in. That's really interesting to talk about all of that.
Okay. Well, if you next time we're talking about whaling, then.
Oh, yeah, we never got round to that.
Never got to whaling.
No, we never got round to whaling. Did you have a final comment about the whaling? Or?
The good thing I like about that movie is reactions you get from all the people, and especially when they say kind of it inspires people. And the story of Greenpeace is, of course, unique, but the story of Greenpeace is an organization. What makes it is people. It's always people. And what it shows with Greenpeace is that if you work together with a group of people on a common objective, and no matter how poor you are, you can still achieve amazing success. And that's really at the core of it. Last week, I think it was on TV, you know, there's a group of women in South Auckland, and they were talking about their victory, and they were very worried about the pokie machines in southern Auckland. And these people came together and they started a campaign to reduce the number of pokie machines, and they had success. And that's for Greenpeace. Whaling was the second campaign we started. It started off with nuclear weapons and then whaling. Now we still have to deal with whaling. It hasn't really stopped yet, eh? So if you look at that, we're not very successful then. And nuclear weapons the same. You are successful because success comes in small amounts, comes in a step-by-step process. You can have your objective, this is what you want to reach, but sometimes it's fairly high and it takes a lot of little steps to achieve that. And I mean, there's so many activists groups has sprung up after Greenpeace and take on a new way and different way. But
I thought it was quite interesting talking Sue Connor, who was managing that waste debacle on Waiheke, and she said something which I hadn't really connected with activism, but that whole thing of bearing witness, that even as she was doing it, she sort of had the feeling that maybe we wouldn't prevail, but that we would be bearing witness to the process. And I think that's the big benefit of things like Greenpeace and the whaling and the anti-nuclear, is that you're there so that people can then say, this is wrong. We might not see a lot of it in the media, but it's wrong, and there are people here who are standing up and saying it's wrong. And it's not just a feeling that you have within you, but there are actually people out there who are saying
exactly. It's at the core, you know. And you know, if you act in a pure non-violent way, you know, then there's nothing they can do against you, you know. That's it. Mm. You speak out and you stand up, and as long as you keep it non-violent, you're okay.
Mm. Well, listen, we've gone over time, but I would like to do you want to just talk about the whaling?
Not now.
Not now? Okay, no, fair enough.
Good. Well, thanks very much for coming in.
Okay.
And talk to you soon.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Hi.
You've been listening to the interviews from last Saturday's Island Life, our weekly magazine show focusing on Waiheke people, events and issues. Island Life is brought to you every Saturday morning from 10 till 12, and the interviews are replayed on Wednesdays at 7 o'clock. They're also available as a download from our website, www.waihekeradio.org.nz. Island Life is brought to you by Island, the shop with Waiheke's most eclectic collection of local art, craft, giftware, clothing and bric-a-brac. Island, Ocean View Road, Onirua.